that if this is a restriction that's going to be placed on us, that it be placed on other companies, other marketplaces, other entities that are entering into these types of contracts.
I have some questions about the Lyft contract, and again, thank you for making it large enough to read. So it does say that it's up to the driver or vehicle operator to decide whether or not to offer a ride to a rider. How does that match with you need to provide rides to people no matter what they look like or whether they have disabilities?
Thank you for that question. Lyft has a very strong anti-discrimination policy, which we hold our drivers accountable to, so they are not permitted to discriminate based on any sort of, race, age, any of those protected classes. And we enforce that through our trust and safety team. And so while they have the choice to decide whether to accept a ride, they cannot decline a ride based on discrimination.
But for all of you, the driver gets to decide whether to accept a particular rider or not. So how do you even know whether they just didn't feel like giving them a ride, or they didn't like the way they looked, or they didn't feel like giving somebody with special needs accommodation?
That's a really good question. And I think one of the features of our app is that it's destination neutral. So at the time when a driver accepts a ride, he or she doesn't actually know where the rider's trying to go. That prevents discrimination based on destination. Moreover, there's no information about, age or sexual orientation or disability except with respect to the need for accessible transit, if applicable, at the time of accepting a ride. Of course, there are many benign reasons why a driver could decline to take a ride. As I said, you can be logged on but running an errand in a grocery store, and perhaps you just sat down to dinner with your family. But at the time, at the time of pickup, at the time where you actually come into contact with the person, we have absolutely zero tolerance for discrimination of any kind.
So what does that actually mean? Because I think that's the key. Given your company's stance on the question of whether you're covered under the ADA, the next best protection we have is that if you determine that a driver is violating civil rights statutes, you have a very big stick, which is you can prohibit them from having access to your platform. Question number one is that your official policy? And number two, have you actually enforced that policy nationwide? So have people been kicked off the platform because you've determined they violated a civil rights statute?
Yes, it absolutely is our policy. It's on our website and, in fact, is enforced against both riders and drivers. So if a rider is discriminatory towards a driver, they equally can lose access to the platform. I'm certain that we have exercised this nationwide. No specific examples are coming to mind. Caitlin, I'm not sure if Caitlin has any, but I'm certain that we have.
We have a very similar policy. As I explained, we have an anti-discrimination policy, and our trust and safety team has deactivated drivers for, if we do receive a valid allegation of discrimination, we have taken the appropriate action.
So I thought that part of this is that you get to see a picture of the person, either the driver or the rider.
So on the Uber app, when you are a rider and you request a ride, a vehicle, you see a photo of your driver as well as the car, make, model, and license plate. But on the Uber platform, the driver does not see a photo of the rider. So if anything, I would address the concerns here that the platform that we're discussing today, in fact, helps to eliminate a lot of the discrimination that we currently see with street hailing.
And I'm interested, and actually that has been the experience of one of my staff, so I appreciate that. I'm interested, though, that the driver doesn't know where the destination is.
The
driver doesn't. They just said the driver doesn't know where they're going.
When it's first.
Right. So supposing you just had a half hour and you were thinking that this was going to be a ride across town and somebody says, well, they want to go to Salem, or even worse, Vancouver at rush hour, is the driver not allowed to say, sorry, I don't have time to take you to Vancouver at rush hour?
That's a good question. And jurisdictions across the country have dealt with this by saying sort of you need to accept a ride of less than X number of miles, maybe 25 or 30 or something like that. That's a possibility. From our perspective, it would not be a discriminatory or problematically discriminatory reason to say, I'm sorry, I can't drive you to San Francisco today. you know, obviously where people would get into trouble is based on a protected characteristic, age, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera.
But what is your policy, both companies' policy, about drivers who don't exceed the limit on the number of hours you can drive as a driver for a TNC company or a taxi company, but who moonlight in some other job where they do driving, so that in a 24-hour period they're actually far exceeding the 14-hour cap? What's your view in terms of the policy and in terms of the safety implications of people driving more than 14 hours if you aggregate all their driving?
It's certainly a concern. We limit the number of hours that a driver can drive on the Lyft platform in a certain day. Unfortunately, we can't control what they're doing outside of their activity on the Lyft platform. I think that's really an issue for the driver to self-regulate. And if the city of Portland would create a rule along those lines, that would really be for the driver to self-regulate, because the TNC can't. They can't know what the driver is doing when they're not on the platform. I mean, we can't even know if they're driving for both Lyft and for Uber. So I think that it's really something that would be on the responsibility of the driver to regulate.
I would only add that I think the problem is actually in some respects bigger than working another job or something like that. If a current taxi driver has a bad night's sleep, you know, we can't control for that, but they're going to be tired the next day. These things happen, and I think obviously distracted and tired driving is a problem, and we do everything we can about that. The only other thing I would note is we have sort of a real-time feedback mechanism where every trip is rated by rider and driver, and I believe Lyft has something similar. So if a rider believes that a driver is too tired or is swerving or something like that, we will hear about it, and we do hear about it right away, and we can reach out and deactivate that driver almost in near real time.
I'd like to add to that, and that's a real distinction from the taxi model, where you don't get that real time feedback. You can't get that real time feedback, and here our passengers are empowered to let us know when that's happening. So I second that.
So Lyft, are we a donations market or are we not a donations market?
Thank you for that question. We don't have any more donations markets, so we would not be a donations market.
Okay. And can you explain to me this cancellation fee of $5 after 5 minutes the rider can't decide this is taking too long, I don't even want the ride?
Yes, I can explain that as well. So when a rider has a driver that is in en route, they are given an estimate for how long it will be for the driver to reach them. So they will know from the outset, okay, well, this driver is 30 minutes away, I'm going to cancel it, it's going to take too long. And so we believe that 5 minutes is a fair amount of time, given that we give a temporal estimate at the very beginning of how long it's going to take the driver to reach the passenger, that 5 minutes is enough time to make that decision, given that you know the geolocation of the driver and you have a 30-minute, 25-minute estimate. Hopefully it would never be 30 minutes, and most of our ETAs in most cities are less than 5 minutes or 7 minutes, and so that really wouldn't be an issue.
But I think that is an issue for our riders, particularly things happen on Portland streets that a ride that was supposed to take 5 minutes. You know, this morning there was a car fire on I-5 that I happily noticed at the exit that I usually get on and went past it and saved myself a half hour delay. But things happen. So that just seems a little retaliatory. And then the damage fee of $250, if a rider has materially damaged the driver's vehicle, how do you go about determining that?
So I'll address the concern of there being some sort of roadblock and the driver taking, a lot longer than our estimate to reach the passenger and the passenger canceling. If that was the case, our passenger could call in to our support line or email into our support line and talk through what had happened. And in that instance, we would most likely issue a refund. We would be able to know in real time, because we have the data through the app, about where the driver was. We can tell that they were stalled on I-5. We can know exactly what happened in real time. And we can say, you know, you're right, this was inequitable, we should refund this passenger. And so that's something that we do on a regular basis. And we're grateful that we have the data so that we can make those decisions about whether or not the refund is appropriate. Yes, so the damage fee. Unfortunately, sometimes passengers do damage vehicles. And if that's the case, we receive a complaint from the driver, usually saying, you know, there's some damage. We receive photographs of the damage. We take testimony from the driver about the damage. We follow up with the passenger. So we do a full investigation before we just, you know, charge that fee.
So why do you limit it to $250? If they slash the leather seats, that would probably be more than $250.
Typically, we haven't had incidents where the damages have exceeded $250, as far as I know.
So is it mainly a vomit charge?
No comment.
Seriously, I mean, I believe that the taxis do have a cleanup fee, and
yeah,
part of what we've been saying, that this is a great opportunity, is for people who are drunk and need
a
ride home.
Part of it is that that does happen from time to time. We do provide safe rides home for people who have had too much to drink, and sometimes that does result in damage to the vehicle. Typically, that's not more than $250 if there's a cleanup fee.
You don't have a standard vomit charge?
Not that I know of. I think we address vomit charges on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. And then I have another question for all three of you.
It's going downhill, but go ahead.
Nurses think about these things.
Apparently.
So why do you want the system to be that you do all the permitting, you do all the background checks, that the city doesn't no longer knows who's doing what?
I'm happy to speak to that. So we've built a system of driver onboarding that involves background checks, that involves vehicle inspections, all sorts of processes to get our drivers onboarded so that we can create a safe platform for our passengers. We don't want to create a duplicative process, because a lot of our drivers are part-time drivers. They're doing this a few hours a week, a few hours a month. We want to make this as easy and as safe as we can for our drivers and for our passengers. So we're really trying to make this a seamless driver onboarding process. We've seen the way that it works in other jurisdictions, where we've had the city sort of involved in the permitting process for the individual drivers, and it's created headaches for the cities, it's created headaches for the drivers, and it's really been a logistical challenge in every direction. So, you know, we've built something that's really efficient and is really safe and working really well, and that's what we want to continue to do.
Okay, then I'll ask the same question to Uber, because there's an online report that over 700 drivers since in this year in Houston have been driving for Uber without having permits.
So Houston is a city where there actually is a duplicative permitting system. There's our entire onboarding process and then an additional process by the city. There are resource constraints on the latter process, is my understanding, and we're trying to work through them with the city in parallel to ensure that as many drivers as possible can get through the process as quickly as possible. As my counterpart for Lyft just pointed out, I think the key here is that these folks are really driving only a few hours a week, 15 hours a week or so is average for us. And what that means is that even modest barriers to enter, be they fees or additional hoops to jump through, really do keep them from taking this opportunity. And it really is an opportunity to earn a little bit of extra money on the side. Say they're a full-time, providing full-time childcare, but have a few hours in the evening and can really contribute to their family. It really provides the opportunity. And then, of course, the more drivers who are on the road, the better the service for consumers across the city. So our goal, which I think the city might share, is to get as many folks on the road as possible to provide as consistent service and as much opportunity to drivers as possible.
Questions for this group? I have some questions for the taxi cab companies, so maybe we'll put you on standby and call up some of them.
But before we do that, I know we've already lost Sue from the Disability Commission. Could we ask Nicole Sharon and the Office of Equity staff to come and give us their perspective?
Sure.
And then if the taxi cab drivers wouldn't mind, thank you. I'd really appreciate
sure.
it.
Good afternoon. Evening. Do you remember the first two?
Thank you. So I think as most flashing, it's mad. Okay, now you can hear me, I think. Thank you. I'm a senior policy advisor for the Office of Equity and Human Rights. I've been working with the team from Commissioner Novick's office and transportation on this sort of from the beginning. We were working on other issues before that. So we've been bringing up sort of the same equity lens issues all along. Part of that, you know, the system is currently broken. It's very clear. So as usual, when things are broken, the people who are most vulnerable suffer the worst consequences. So that's been what we've been concerned about. Because the way the city has previously regulated the number of businesses, that has caused a lack of employment mobility for drivers. So there's like no competition in terms of being, you know, the best company to work for. And we recognize that there is a concern about the recognition of the driver vulnerability, and with the pilot, we've been concerned about how that might affect incomes. And I'm glad some people make good money, but we have a lot of proportion of drivers are immigrant refugee from populations, and you know those folks are working really hard on a very thin margin to do a lot for those families. And so I've had many conversations with folks in those communities about their concerns. I also just wanted to say that we think the move into transportation has been great. I know Commissioner Novick, you made early commitments to all the issues that we've had concerns around equity. You know, Leah Treat's been great. Everybody has shared the concerns. It's a very complicated issue. But we are certainly right in there trying to imagine that we are hampered by the same things you've heard from everyone else. There is not data. You know, I mean, I think in 212 there was a request for data. So we would really like to understand more of what's going on. And like everyone else, we're looking at an unknown. In terms of the, you know, Sue is serving from PCOD on the committee. She's doing a terrific job doing that. And I think they've been very clear about what their goals are. We are certainly feel like there needs to be a clear intent about goals and enforcement regarding accessible vehicles from the get-go. And looking forward to the work that is planned to be done in phase two on the PEAK plan, and there's going to be a subcommittee, and Sue will be a part of that, and they can have technical assistance come in on that. So that'll be a great opportunity to dig further into that. As to other areas, I'm really happy Nicole's here because she can bring her perspective, which hasn't come to the table before.
So I think it's an interesting issue. People are kind of asking about the ADA title, which this affects. And I agree with Ken. It is a Title III issue. But in my mind, what's Title III about it is that whatever Uber is putting out there needs to be compliant, meaning the website needs to be compliant, meaning they need to accept rides with people who have a service animal. It doesn't mean that they need to have vehicles that, say, can accommodate an electric wheelchair. The taxi system has been very challenged, especially over the last few years, as we're getting more and more people using mobility devices. We have a larger aging population, and a lot of those taxis are hired out by the school systems and by medical transport. And so they're not actually available for transportation of someone like me who maybe needed to go to a PBM exercise and ended up waiting an hour and a half for a cab one day. I think this process will really make positive changes with that. I think you guys have a long road ahead of you, But I think this is kind of a jumping off point where we really can start to fix the whole system. And I do want to say that, and I've really only been brought into it over the last few days, but the PEEP is a very interesting proposal because unlike other jurisdictions in other cities who are focusing on, in regards like to the taxis, the percentage of wheelchair accessible vehicles, the PEEP focuses on the response time. And I think that's actually a very clever way to go because you could have 20% of your vehicles accessible. New York has just said they want 50% by 2020. You might have 50% of the vehicles accessible, but if they're all being hired out by the school districts and by medical transport, they're not going to be available for people who are just visiting Portland and are in a wheelchair and need to kind of get to the convention center. So I think those are things that need to really be worked in it, but I don't think it's something that can't move forward.
I'm really pleased that you addressed this question of moving to a standard of service model because I agree with Steve. It does seem like a more rational way of figuring, of at least at our end, setting the standard, and then it's for the TNCs to meet it. It's rather than arbitrarily declaring a percentage of your fleet, which may or may not be sufficient. Do you have a overall concern about the position that the TNCs, at least Uber, has taken, that they are not covered by Title III of ADA?
They are covered by Title III. I mean, they're not a taxi service in that they don't have a place that they operate out of, but they would be covered for the things like I mentioned, their website, their accessibility to not telling people that they can't have a ride because they have a service animal. And within that is Title III. I mean, like, they're offering a service to people. That service needs to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities.
Well, Nicole, the United States Justice Department agrees with you, but one of my concerns on this is, I have two concerns. One is the lack of clarity about what law applies, and mm-hmm. a company taking the position that we're not bound by perhaps the most important civil rights law of the last 50 years. And second, whether that rather sharp legal position is indicative of a corporate culture that may be less attentive to access and equality issues generally. I think there are on both fronts questions we have to grapple with. At the end of the day, we have to make sure that we have full compliance with our laws.
Agreed.
I did want to say one other thing is that through this process, it's so clear that the system is broken beyond this transportation. You know, I'm sure you know that the medical transportation changed hands, and my understanding is that's why some of the other services are available because they didn't get that, TriMet did not retain the contract that they had for that. So there's lots of problems everywhere, and the more we can find solutions, the better we're all going to feel about that.
So, Nicole, just like your perspective as a user of this transportation services,
sure.
Is there capacity in the system?
Is there capacity of the taxis?
No, the two ride connection, for example, and the other one, which I hadn't heard of.
I think that with ride connection, I mean, I don't know all of the ins and outs, but my guess is if they were to go into contract, they would get more vehicles. They're actually doing very well. And it's not a matter of, it's a matter of the fleet, really. If you have enough fleet, you can meet that demand. I think what has been the standard for a lot of the medical transport services is you have like an hour window that you can potentially have to wait to get that service. And I think what happens with the PEEP, if that's in place, they will then have to provide the service within, say, the 20-minute margin that shows. And I think if they're saying they can do it, they will do it.
Do you think, though, if there aren't additional vehicles, that will mean that somebody who doesn't have a smartphone has to wait even longer for a wheelchair-accessible van because the transportation network company is going to be able to provide, to snag it faster?
I mean, I think what's interesting is with an organization like Ride Connections, they're not based on smartphones. So if they're kind of the go-to, what would probably happen in my mind, I don't know, but if Uber then calls Ride Connections, Ride Connections have things in place that are phone based. It's not computer based. So that might alleviate some of that concern as well of people not being served.
Mm-hmm. Can I also say the board? Oh, I'm sorry. Just the
transportation board just approved new companies, including some that have been in the queue for a long time. I can't figure that out. And they are. So they will provide additional. I know the PBX Yellow said that they're.
I actually had a question, which is we've got these data collection requirements, and a major purpose of the data collection is to see what kind of service people with disability issues are getting. Commissioner Fritz has suggested that rather than starting a pilot and collecting data once the pilot's been started, we should collect this kind of data from the taxi cab industry up front and delay starting the pilot until after that. Do you think that there is a danger that if we don't do as Commissioner Fritz says, we might wind up collecting data in the pilot that should show that service has gotten worse, but we won't know because we haven't seen how service was to begin with?
So my two cents on data collection is it's great if people are able to provide it. I actually think it's more important that we have a way that the community can provide the feedback versus getting it from the taxis or the Uber drivers. I have a real concern about where that data would come from and how that would be. I don't know if there's a fail-proof technical way that the taxis would report that, or would they be self-reporting? And so I would be okay going forward with the pilot, but I would want to set up a mechanism for especially the disability community to say, how long were your rides? We're being told they were in compliance, but were they? I just think it needs to have a check and balance with a user.
Do you think that if we can find a way to collect that feedback from customers, then we could also effectively ask them, are you getting worse service now than you were before this pilot started?
Absolutely. And I think that would be an effective pulse on the community of how it is working.
Mm-hmm. So I think we see. Just one question I had is right on this data reporting issue, long list of, which maybe you've seen, of data that we want to collect from both your companies and from the TNCs during this pilot project phase and after, I suppose. Tell us your thoughts about the, can you do this? Can you provide that data?
I find that, Ray Miles, Broadway Cab, and Sassy's Cab. The whole data question is a very interesting one. To be honest, to date, nobody's asked us for data. I've heard a rumor that Mr. Hockaday asked a radio cab driver to get data from Broadway, but that wasn't very effective. So honestly, we can provide data on response times. Somebody's got to ask us. It isn't something we usually pony up.
There's a lot more response time on this list, but yeah.
Yes. Now, we are a service that doesn't always collect, like at the time of the call, doesn't always collect the destination. When that bartender calls, he just says, I've got to ride at this bar. So some of them, with some exceptions, yes, I think most of the larger companies can provide it. The smaller ones, it is, I believe, still manually tracked, and they would have more of a challenge.
Ray, does that mean that if we ask you for this kind of data for the past couple of months, you could retroactively provide it?
Yes. Going back more than 90 days gets challenging. Within 90 days, yes. In fact, the city has asked for data in the past, but typically they get it and they don't know what to do with it. So there hasn't been a lot of, I can see why they aren't asking, because they haven't been able to use it very effectively.
Uh, I'm Steve Antler from Radio Cab. Yeah, there was a request back in 2012 to give a certain amount of data, and one of the things was that I gleaned through and looked in the past was the percentage of wheelchair trips as a ratio of all of our trips. And since we didn't contract with TriMet Medical Transportation or anything at that time, on a monthly and weekly basis, our total amount of wheelchair trips compared to the other trips was less than 0.5% of our total rides produced. So an awful lot of the rides that you hear about actually go through contracted agencies and stuff.
So you work in contract?
No, we don't. We've got one with PPS, but that's the only one.
Okay. I have a question for this panel. You've heard now over two hearings, well, a hearing and now this work session, a conversation about whether it's fair to lift price controls on TNCs but to continue to regulate taxis during the 120-day period. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my name is Kadir Wako from Union Cab. All the cab company and cab driver are asking things to be fair. On this task force issue, we are really disappointed how the system was going. Instead of adding better regulation, destroying the existing regulation in the den, just to make fit on the clock of Uber. So we are, our drivers are, like I said last time, really concerned that this is about the livelihood of other people. These cab drivers, like we said before, I still want to say that if we lose this job, most of our drivers will be homeless. There is no any way even they can get a McDonald's job. So when we want to put maybe over 2,000 via permit on the road, and it started to show that last year, 2 years ago, $6.25 the driver make. What does it change? Why we have to make now $2.50 for the drivers to make hourly? And please, still, let's think, be fair. All drivers, they support technology. We all support technology. We all support new things. But not to impose with the other people who trying to make living. It's just about the making living and the not to live now. It's just a simple thing. Union Cab is 2 years old. And when we get the permit, we didn't come and impose on the city of Portland. On the city of Portland, you have to give it to me or not. I'll enter it. It takes us a process of 3 years, as you all are aware, maybe Mr. Hale, Mayor Haley, Mr. Novik wasn't here, you all know. It takes me 3 years to file and to get the permit. Actually, I support that. It's a legal way. I have to be proof that I can provide that service. But when now come in and say, here, City of Portland, you have to change your policy and do it this way, do it the way I want it. Why a union cab with poor immigrant drivers providing a $500,000 insurance, why Uber with a $41 billion doesn't provide a simple and clear word? They should provide simply $500,000 insurance. Simple. It's for the public safety, for the drivers, for the city. Let's just be fair.
I appreciate your sort of global perspective about your view of the fairness of the process and whether we should change our rules. But I guess what I would also invite from our guests is if the city were to do a 120-day experimental period and the recommendation from the task force is we would lift price controls for one entity, TNCs, but not for taxi cabs, do you have a view about that recommendation? And I... accepting that you disagree perhaps with the whole frame of the conversation, but if the council gets to the question of a 120-day period, can you give us some guidance as to whether it's fair to regulate taxis and not TNCs, and if not, what suggestions would you have us for that 120-day period only?
Let regulate the tax as existing code. Let the cab company. Let's say a driver A, one of union cab driver can take from downtown to airport for $100. And then one of Broadway driver can take maybe for $25. That's what hurting the public, not even only the company. So less regulated, the same regulation should apply for TNC, and the less them charge it with a flat rate, whatever they want to charge it from here to airport or from where to where. And then we'll apply to that rules.
Yeah, my name is Tasfai, and I'm from Green Cab. Well, my take on this thing is it's a process. I'm trying to say the process is if we have a broken system which is not, we think is not working, are we trying to break it and then try to fix it, or are we trying to take all the bad things out and then correct it in the way that is going to give us time and, you know, time and judgment, so that we're not going to dump into a place where we're going to be having issues. In the first place, I mean, there are companies that have been permitted, you know, just recently, and there are some permits that were given. At the same time, we have, you know, added expenses into those, in order to fulfill the rules that were given. Okay, if the cap is lifted, here is the scenario that we're going to have. If before I add one vehicle, Lyft or Uber will add 1,000 vehicle because of the process. I have to paint, I have to bring the wheelchair, I have to put mirror, I have to put radio, I have to put all these things. As I have said it on my testimony, I have not even received the vehicles that I have purchased a month ago. So I have to wait another 4 months, 4 weeks to get all these things done. So are we sure that it's going to be fair if we say, okay, we take everything out and then let's see the 120 days? Well, why can't we see the 120 days if needed within the framework of the regulatory basis and then require the companies to give information every time? Those are the kind of things I would rather see, so that we will be reporting, we'll be giving you information, and then we'll do that. By the way, we are, as a company, as Green, my company is insuring $1 million auto liability. So I can give you an example. Like when somebody was trying to raise the issue of insurance, like the skater, the issue of like the Jupiter. Yes, it is not because we have enough insurance that all these things were settled. Those kind of things has to be very carefully measured. And the other thing I just want to mention, I don't know if it's a question, on the fee. The fee, the taxi, that the industry is paying company fee, vehicle fee, driver fee. These are fees that the city is collecting. At the same time, Commissioner Fritz was asking, at the same time, income tax or income collections, those are in addition. And at the same time, when there are vehicles that are going to be taken out and replaced, there is a fee. All these things are there.
So hold that thought for a second, because yeah. Commissioner Novick, this question about how you structure an experimental period and have a level playing field when there are two systems, and one of which, because of a different set of regulations, imposes a different set of costs that this gentleman is referring to, at least in my mind, goes to the heart of what we're at least debating here, is how do you structure a level playing field if someone has to make these investments or has made these investments, which
I've already made that
change their cost structure. Would it be possible for PBOT to give us just a little cheat sheet to compare the sort of existing regulations and what we think the cost of compliance is, and compare it to, say, a Lyft or Uber in terms of what their requirements would be?
I don't think that we know what the cost of compliance for the TNCs will be of having to meet a service standard for wheelchair accessibility, for example. I asked Ray a couple of weeks ago if she could give me information on what percentage of her company's costs are related to providing accessible service, and I'm waiting for an answer on that. I mean, I think that, though, you need to think about the question. I mean, if we've adopted arbitrary rules which require people to make investments, like 20% of the fleet has to be accessible, and if we think it makes more sense to adopt a service standard, do we really want to say, well, it would make more sense, but we need to wait for 5 years for the taxi cab companies to recoup their investments in those vehicles?
Fair enough. And let me state it slightly differently. If the taxi companies could demonstrate that their costs of compliance with regulations we put in place puts them at a competitive disadvantage during the experimental period, if they could make that case, what tools do we have to address that imbalance, including in any transition period, in either the first 120 days or thereafter? Could we structure a system that acknowledged that they had to incur costs under the prior set of rules that may put them at a competitive disadvantage, and then how would we account for that?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, one option, although my staff didn't like this idea, would be, for example, to say that in terms of accessible service, we could say that the TNCs immediately have to meet a certain service standard, but the taxi cabs can either meet a service standard or continue to meet the 20% fleet standard. I'm not sure that's a great idea, but it's something that I was coming up with contemplating exactly the question you raise. But I mean, whenever government changes rules in any topic, I think that there will be some people who have made some sort of investment under the old rules, and they'll say, and new people won't have to. And I don't know that the government can always say, we are going to make sure that everybody who is operating under the old rules gets made whole for any assumptions they might have made about the rules staying the same.
The question, too, is about the fee structure, right? So it's either TNCs are deregulated, taxis are still regulated, both are unregulated, both are regulated.
Yeah, which do you think will provide better protection, I think, is another way to answer
right.
the question.
In my opinion, the first thing I will do is there will be a time that all of us as an industry has to think to change. If we have to do, we need to get time and adapt to a system. If at all, if everybody wants to go to a deregulation, there has to be some kind of study where everybody is going to be play the same role.
But should the rule be for this test period, should it be that everybody has to charge the rates that you charge, or should it be that
everybody has to be charging the same thing? All of us have to be treated to the same standard.
But what would happen if the council adopted the recommendation of the task force, but with a twist, and said that the same deal is available to taxis, unregulated pricing? What would happen over 120 days if the city relieved the pricing regulations on you as an industry? How would that affect you positively or negatively?
Okay. In my opinion, it will make it worse. That's what my take is going to be, because the industry is deregulated. There are some kind of group or people or individuals who can come with some kind of, 120 days drive and do whatever they want to do, and then they may get out. But the industry is here to stay. That's what, if at all, But what happens is all the drivers that are working for companies will go out and start having their own company. And then the one company might go out, but the other companies might be there. Those small companies will have a lot of problems. So this is one thing that we have to know. But we're not opposing any adoption. We're not opposing any addition or anything, except we need to study it to really see what's coming.
So if the pricing was, if your prices went down to what Uber and Lyft have been charging, what effect would that have on your drivers? If it was like half what you're currently?
My name is Vyacheslav Karhu, Portland Taxi. Driver, manager, dispatcher, owner, mechanic, just about anything there is in this industry. There's no way in how we can compete with these people because there's the cost. You see, my water bill just came from city of Portland. I haven't flushed a toilet single time. It was close to $100. I have not even used a single drop of water. So that's the cost involved of running the infrastructure. The same thing we have. We have cost. You know, there's employees, there's fees, there's taxes, there's rent, there's all kinds of. There's no way how we can go to $1.10 a mile. There's no way. Just, it's unfeasible.
Could you make up for that, though, by, I mean, doing what surge pricing like Uber and Lyft do and say, okay, we're going to charge much more during times of peak demand?
Okay. Anybody, Ray or?
I don't think it's necessary cab company to do that. It's been accepted. It's the public, Portland public, now that it's regulated by the city. And so surcharging is, first off, is another part of exploitation, or I can't say it's a roadway theft.
Well, there's another practical problem, I guess, because the TNCs, when they apply surge pricing, notify their customers through the app that there's a premium to be paid. If we gave you the authority to have surge pricing, it effectively would be saying that once the passenger got in the car, you'd be having a negotiation each time, which also creates its own complications because the passenger may not like the fee you're proposing. You have a negotiation, that person gets out. I'm not sure mechanically how you would do that unless you published your rates and had.
Yeah, even so, I mean, as breathlessly as the people in this room have been following the discussion we've been having for 9 hours of council session and 10 meetings and all the rest, there are tens of thousands of people who have no idea that we're having this conversation at all, and they're going to show up in front of the Hilton and say, take me to the airport, and expect to know what the deal is, right? So, aside from the fact that this experiment may or may not happen, there's still going to be a whole bunch of people for whom it's a surprise.
We could adopt a requirement that whenever somebody calls to ask for a cab and says where they're going, that the cab company has to tell them what the charge will be.
It has to be at least some permit. It's a regulated rules, because let's say there are some issues. A cab driver trying to take from PDX airport to downtown. Some driver take on Highway 84. Some of them take on Sandy. A customer who used to come always to downtown will complain that that's a longer way. And then it make a complaint or, you know, another disagreement with the driver and the customer. In Uber case, the customer already know that, aware that in the head for this mile is going to be charged.
And the other thing that we have to understand is that we cannot be telling the customer that, oh, it's because it's up today, or it's because it's down today. And we're not going to tell them that, well, everything is deregulated, so we're going to charge everything. And they will have, you know, the customers will just, you know, is it calling the company or the city? How do we resolve with the driver whom we have told, charge whatever you want to charge, and then come back again and say, well, you charged customer A this much. How do we do that? How do we deal with it? So those are the kind of things that we have to be very careful about.
Can I ask you just a question? Say to this gentleman who said that he has $100, I know you're using your water bill metaphorically, yeah, but if you are truly not using any water, would you send me a copy of your bill? Take a look at it. It's actually two-thirds sewer stormwater, one-third water, but if you're truly not using any water, let's take a look. And we may be overcharging you, and that every little bit helps here. So.
They said that, you're at the old rate, so they just readjust the new rate. So it's actually,
Can I weigh in on the 120 days before we move on? May I? Commissioner Fish, you asked for any recommendations we have, and Yes, I have a recommendation, which is don't do it. This thing is going to create way more problems than it's going to solve, I believe. And I just want to go on record just in case I'm right. And I think it will. But I also think, you know, if nothing else, before that trial period starts, we should nail down all the safety issues. We should firmly nail down insurance, the driver permitting, and background checks. They keep coming up as separate topics, but historically in the city of Portland, they are the same topic. And I think all the safety stuff should be nailed down. Then, if you want to go into some trial periods, what I would suggest, what I think makes a lot of sense, would be to start, you know, under sort of controlled circumstances, putting out a limited number of vehicles, study the data, evaluate. So if the goal of the trial period is to sort of assess what is the right balance in the marketplace, I don't see how overnight flooding the city with these vehicles that the taxis can't possibly compete with will be fair or in anybody's best interest.
Thank you. And could you talk some more about the safety issues? Talk about supervision of your drivers. If you get a complaint to any of you about your driver, what steps do you take and how is that followed up?
One of the beauties of the taxi cab industry traditionally is not only can you call in and give a complaint to give us immediate feedback, we get immediate feedback on drivers from people who aren't even in our cars because they see the car and say, hey, I think he's speeding. I should call and let Broadway know. They would want to know. So we do have trained staff to at all 24/7, 365, our dispatchers are there to capture the information. They know what sort of represents a critical, urgent, contemporaneous complaint and what is sort of just a process complaint. So if it's something right now where we think there is imminent danger, imminent threat, they can call a manager. They can get whatever assistance right then to get to the heart of an issue. If it's more of a routine complaint, they gather the information, and then when normal business hours start, somebody gets a hold of that passenger, and we do a thorough investigation. Usually, the city is involved, and we work. Not usually. Sometimes the city is involved. We work hand in hand with them and stay at it until we know the passenger and the city are satisfied that we've gotten to the bottom of the issues and have taken action.
Ray, what percentage of your drivers do you think make over $50,000 a year?
Steve didn't get a chance, so.
Well, we always threaten our drivers by sending them to green or yellow. just to weigh in on that, the pricing structure and Tessa hit on some of it. It's like, how do you make the expenses of the companies more equal? And getting back to my premise that I testified on, which is the city really needs to individually permit the drivers. And, you know, the elephant in the room here is actually the insurance, but it's not Uber's insurance or it's not Lyft's insurance. It's actually the personal auto insurance of the drivers. And that's the reason they don't want any part of you knowing who the drivers are so that you can make it a provision that they supply personal auto insurance data to the city. And and they have to notify their company that they are doing part-time service as a TNC driver. You know, as a practical matter, when an accident occurs, I don't care if it's period 1, 2, 3, or 0, at the scene of that fender bender, an insurance card generally gets produced. And what would you think insurance card is going to come out in virtually every accident? It's not going to be Ubers. It's not going to be Lyfts. It's going to be the personal auto insurance card. And most of the time, it'll never get any farther than their carrier. So, in essence, all the other policyholders throughout the United States are paying for the commercial activities of a few TNC drivers. If they get canceled out and required to have a different type of insurance for their personal auto insurance, that does something to equalize the balance.
Let me go back to Commissioner Fritz's complaint response. We usually get complaints on the internet. We have, on our website, there is a complaint form. We get that form, or people on the road calls us, or they send us, you know, a kind of a call. When there are, you know, significant problem, what we do is we just follow up, or we call the supervisor, road supervisors, we call them, and then we ask them follow up and let us know. And then the, all those things follow up to the city, to the company. Or what we get is from the city gets call, by the way. The city gets a lot of call. I don't know, I mean, I've not heard that the city gets a lot of call. And the city does what does is they forward it, say, that's fine, I got this complaint. What happened? Investigate or tell me about this driver. Where was he? What did he do? What time was he? Then those are the most important things that we needed to make sure that we are regulating things appropriately. When the city gets a complaint, we do the job. That's what they do. I mean, they send it to us, and we do the job, and then we report back to the city, this is what happened. Or if the city thinks they can take action, they will call their driver and talk to their driver. That's what happened, because they have the information of the driver. It's not the green. It's the city who, which is responsible for issuing that permit and things. And the other thing that we have to make sure is the insurance. Okay, I'm just coming back to the insurance of the TNC. If they are claiming that up on, up off, okay, my driver is standing at the Hilton. That's up off. Then, when he's driving, what is going to be happening from Hilton to the pickup area? Wherever he's going to pick up. Is it up off? Or a customer in? Okay, up on. Then, he's going to load the customer. Then is that, you know, going to be, which insurance are we going to use? Those are seriously considered, those kind of things. The permit fee. The vehicle has to be permitted separately. The vehicles has to be permitted separately. The drivers have to be permitted separately. And the company has to be permitted separately. I just paid this month the whole fleet, with the old fleet, the whole fleet, the shuttle, the medical transportation, and the shuttle medical and the taxi. I have paid the three companies thing. If staff is here, they know that. So those things, if those things are there, then I don't think we'll have an issue. The number of the experience has to be given, the TNC has to be given a number somewhere for the trial period, some number. We can agree on that. That number, if they do that number, then I think it was Darren, we can, you know, see how, if they can on and off and, you know, limit the number of people that are working or not. Those kind of things can be coming between the period before everything is gone away. All these things has to go through before we break everything. We will, you know, fix it before we break it. That's what I will agree.
Just for the record, the drivers are very hard and expensive commodity. They're not easy to find. They're not easy to train. This is not something that comes easily. In other words, if these things will kick in, what's going to happen is you're going to lose a lot of quality drivers that's been driving for years and years and years. Most likely, this driver is going to go drive the semi-trucks, you know, UPS trucks, whatever, you know, they will move on. It will be blown to the industry, because what's going to happen, you're going to, in my words, slaughter the working cows that brings milk, and you're going to introduce this instant GMO packets, in my opinion.
Just a sort of a general question. I mean, it's really unusual
to limit the number of participants in a market. I mean, an analogy I can think of is restaurants, which are a regulated industry. They have to meet health and safety standards. And recently, they've been subject to competition by something that I think is mildly analogous. We have food carts now, which don't have the same sort of expenses that restaurants have. So a question that, I mean, the same sort of infrastructure expenses. So a question I have for you is, should we limit the number of restaurants? Should we have prohibited food carts?
Okay, let me start, and then I need help. Okay. The first thing that we have to determine is, I think, as far as I understand, taxis are considered as utilities. Most of the utilities are controlled. And I heard an analogy that FDA controls meat. So why do